Hello and welcome, fellow ramblers, to today's ramble. I'm Lucas Kitchen. Thanks for joining me. So, what's going on? Well, I've been feeling down for a few days, but I'm feeling good today. My wife got home from her trip and we talked late last night and I don't know. I just told her how I've been feeling and that helps. You know, we talked a long time and shared various ideas and thoughts and things that we've been thinking about. So that was nice. That helped. A lot of times, the fix for a brooding mood is fellowship. You know, I don't know. It just seems to happen that way. Hey, let's look at today's, verse of the day. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. Isaiah 40:11. That's beautiful. Just kind of like the character of God, right? Just the character of God in that he is after those who are, I don't know, brokenhearted. He's after the sheep. He's after those who stray. He's after those who need shepherding. It does seem like he resists the proud. Why do I think that? Because he says so. But maybe that's why the metaphor of sheep is used so much. It's like sheep aren't proud. Actually, I don't know if they're proud, but they don't seem proud. Sheep aren't proud. They follow. You know, they're willing to go along. So that's pretty. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. He's gentle. He made the universe. He wrote the laws of nuclear fission, but he's also gentle with his lambs. It's pretty amazing. Speaking of nuclear fission and just the universe in general, you probably have heard this before, but I was talking with my wife last night. She thought I should talk about this on the podcast. I was telling her about this, some of my thoughts about how weird it is that we live in a universe that corresponds to math. But let me zoom out and kind of paint that picture because I think it's really interesting. So, like when you're young and you're in the lower grades, you learn subjects in isolation, you know, like you learn language arts and you learn math and you learn, I don't know, social studies and whatever. I don't even know what all the subjects are, but you learn them. But then as you progress in your studies, those subjects converge. Like I remember realizing in chemistry in high school that what we had learned in algebra could actually predict things in chemistry. And in fact, like it was so weird to me that this abstract idea of algebra could then be used to explain chemical bonds. It's like, what is math doing in this science class, you know? And as you raise up and go higher and higher, it's like the subjects converge more and more to the point where if you had like the most powerful mind in the universe, you could probably even give the mathematical formula for human language or something, you know? I mean, I think it all converges. But to some extent we see, although this might be different, but we see like the ability in high computation, like in computing to vectorize language and then basically do what AIs do. That is what an AI is doing, so to speak, is it's able to emulate through a layered set of, you know, structured logical computational processes. It's able to mimic actual human language. And so I think everything in the universe is, you know, as you get deeper into understanding things, things converge and converge and converge. And if you think of that as in a shape, what shape is that? Well, down at the base, it's very broad, and up at the top, it would be basically an infinitesimal point. It would be what is that, a vertex, I suppose, if you're describing a shape. And what is that? Well, I know that some would call it a triangle, but I would call it an arrow, and I think it's pointing towards something. If all of the subjects in the universe can converge into one sort of theory of everything, I know some atheists think, you know, that there'd be a theory of everything just because, but why? Why would there be a single converging theory of everything in a random built universe? Like, if the universe was random, if it was made out of chaos, from chaos it came, therefore to chaos it would go, I don't think you would see this coherency, you know, this converging of subject matter into this vertex type concept that points to something, you know. And it's so odd to me that you can study math theoretically, and you can learn math theoretically, and then this thing that you thought was so isolated and so separate and so different and so abstract then can be used to predict things in the real world. And not only predict, but explain and describe what is happening in the real world. Like let's say you hold two things in your hand. Well, yeah, you have two items, but is the number two a real thing? No, it isn't. It's a theoretical concept. The number two does not actually exist. It is outside of the universe and only within your thought space, your conceptualizer, your, you know, it's an idea. It's like a, what was it that Plato called it? A form, I think. The Platonic form or whatever. That doesn't feel right. It wasn't form. It was the, you know, his concept of the ideal, concept, or I can't remember what he called that, but anyway, and so you can have this like train of thought, this, causeway of thought that is coherent, and it runs alongside the universe and can predict the universe, and in a sense can like mentally be layered on top of the universe. And it lines up perfectly. And that is just insane. That's insane unless it was purpose-built. Unless it was designed for that to be the case. It's like the idea that an abstract discipline that happens within your mind can then also cohere with the real world and the real universe is, I can't imagine a different explanation for that if we are from chaos and also therefore to chaos. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, if we're from chaos, we're going to chaos. But if we experience order in the processes that we live within, then that means we have to have come from order. You know, if you are from order, you go to order. If you're from chaos, you go to chaos, and everything in between would be, you know, of the same essence. And so there you have this very odd coherency between the abstract world of the mind and the real world of physical matter and things. And how weird is it also that the mind is designed to require, I mean, like, for it to be a coherent thought, like, it's like the mind is designed to reject the incoherent and to accept the coherent, basically the real possible, you know, the things that could be, maybe they aren't, you know, it's kind of the idea of the abstract. It's like something that could be but isn't. You know, it's, you know, and so the idea that the mind is designed to be that way is also very odd. And that lines up, that's like, that can be layered on top of the experience that's happening in the cosmos is very bizarre. I feel like I'm speaking in a way that's hard to really grasp the feel of, because what I care about is the feel. I want you to feel this thing that I feel. So let me do another angle. Music is interesting in this because it has a similar kind of odd coherency. So let's say you take a really great jazz musician, and I pick jazz because it's complex. Jazz is very complex. I don't know if it's the most complex, but it's very complex. You know, let's say you get like a jazz fusion player. I like the guys. I like the music that Snarky Puppy puts out. You know, let's say you take that or, I don't know, whoever, but I like them. So let's say you take jazz and you tell them you tell the jazz musician, do something that's like fun to listen to, but is like just kind of wild. Well, you know, he's going to do stuff that you may be like, wow, I haven't heard that before. Okay, so let's say he does an original piece. You've never heard that arrangement of notes and that rhythm before, and you put it all together. But then let's say you bring in a mathematician who is also an expert in music theory. He then can go through what was just played, and he can define it all with mathematical equations. He can say, okay, so this harmonic interval, this minor third, this is a minor third, and that happens because of the harmonic interval here, and that is based on, you know, and there's certain fractions. You can say, okay, this octave here is, half the string distance of the, you know, the original note. And I mean, you just take all of those things. And he can define it. And that is so weird. If you really think about it, it's cause like what the jazz musician was doing was just playing things that were like pleasant to him, you know, and he wasn't thinking that a triplet is like a triple divided, you know, note pattern. He just was like, no, that just felt good. That felt right to do that, you know? And so it's like, something that feels good musically, which comes from the human brain, can then be translated into math. And then you can then create, because this is what music theory is, you can then create a set of basically mathematical instructions to follow that then recreates a pleasant experience that is not the same as the original. So then you could take those rules that mathematician music theorist writes and say, okay, now use those same type of rules and create some new thing. And he could actually write out some jazz piece that no one's ever played before, but it follows those rules, and it would then be translated back into the human ear, and it would be pleasant. That's insane. That means that something that comes out of your mind can be translated into math and then translated back from math into an experience. This is the convergence to me. This is the concept that everything in the universe, all of the disciplines converge into this single, I don't know what it is, like a mind experience that God has made, you know, made available to us to experience and to study. And it seems like he's done it in a way that he wants us to study. Here's the other like crazy thing about like music, for instance, is let's say that you have all that and you realize that it's coherent with the laws of math. It's coherent with the laws of proportion or the laws of symmetry or whatever, you know, whatever the laws are you want to call them. But you recognize these set of laws, and then you do things that follow those laws, and you create a set of frequencies, which, by the way, are a mathematical. I mean, it's like sine wave, you know? So you create these sine waves or various kind of waves that follow these harmonic rules that are mathematical, and then that hits your ear, and there is no reason why the cochlea in your ear then can take that and turn it into emotion. Like why in the world, if survival of the fittest was really the thing, that determines how the universe operates. Why in the world does a minor third feel sad? You know, why in the world does a major triad feel hopeful and happy? Why does a seventh chord feel kind of like playful a little bit, right? There's no reason for that if it's survival of the fittest. I mean, some have proposed these ideas that like, well, maybe that helped with, you know, tribal cohesion or some goofball stuff like that. I'm just like, no. What that says is that we can go beyond just saying it's by intelligent design. It's intelligent design where the designer wanted us to have enjoyment. He wanted us to have enjoyment that was just extracurricular. It was just for funsies, you know, and that's what music is. There's no real need for it in a world of survival of the fittest. And we see that in the animal kingdom, by the way, where maybe there is some sense of truth to like the most fit do survive. They don't really need music, you know. They make noises, but they don't sing, not the way we do, not with the kind of complex harmonies that we create. And so is the world running on survival of the fittest? Yes, in some ways, but was the world shaped by that? Was the world created by that? Were species created by that? I do not think so, because of music and because of these other like art forms that have no other explanation. Now, one possible explanation for someone that's coming from like an atheistic mindset would be to say, well, it's good for memorizing things, you know, and for humans, they need to memorize. But wouldn't it be much easier to just evolve a brain that just is a steel trap for things that need to be memorized? That would be easier than this complex export of frequency intervals that then has to be translated into a very complex process in the brain. It'd be way easier just to have a brain that just remembers stuff, you know, than, you know, and so it's like, yes, it does help with memorization if you set something to music, but I think that's because it attaches emotions to it. But I think that's an outcome, that's a byproduct, and it's a valuable one. But it's way easier just to say, yeah, we have a creator that wanted a coherent universe. And we had a creator who wanted the apex beings in that coherent universe to have enjoyments of various kinds, pleasures of various kinds that were not just for the function of survival, but that were for the purpose of fellowship with their very good God. So it's coherent. It lines up with math. It lines up with these other laws that we can both observe. But the crazy thing is the theoretical stuff that we can then extrapolate. You know, like math can predict things that we haven't actually seen. Math can predict things that are not yet empirical, right? And so this is one of those, like, I might call it like subjective proofs of the existence of a creator, is just this concept that the abstract world of the mind is coherent with the concrete world of material things. You know, isn't it Ecclesiastes that says that he has put eternity in people's hearts? Why did that pop into my head right now? I don't know exactly, but it did. He's put eternity into the hearts of man or something like that. It's like I think in a very specific way, the open-hearted person who pursues these ideas. Okay, so like there's people that look at a tree and it's just beautiful, and it's a sunset, you know, dappling through the branches and the tree and the leaves, and they just say, it's beautiful, there must be a God. Right? There's that kind of person. Okay, there's people that doesn't do it for them, and I don't know why, but it just doesn't. There's some people that, they hear an opera. Why opera? I don't know. Maybe they hear a rock song, their favorite alternative band. Mine is a band called My Epic. Some of their songs I'm just really moved by, you know. It's hard rock. It's what I grew up with. So it's familiar to me and I like it. And they talk about Jesus, you know, but in a poetic way. And some of their things, I hear it and it's like, man, yeah. Yeah, we have a good God, don't we? And I just feel that, you know. For some, they're very deep thinkers, and I'm a medium thinker. You know, I kind of live in between the space. I don't go as deep as some people, but like, some people are such deep thinkers that they find God at that convergence point. You know, they find God at the place where math meets chemistry or something like that. And it's just like, they just put it together, the pieces, that this just can't be. Well, you know, hard stop. This just can't be. But it is. And that realization, I think, often leads people to a creator. Like, this can't be. This doesn't make sense that this could be. Except, unless there is a designer. And can we describe why there's a designer? Not in the least. I mean, don't kid ourselves. We don't need to kid ourselves. We don't know why God exists. We don't know why his energy is eternal. What in the world does that even mean? I don't know. It's just too much to say that it's not intentional. And the idea that the universe is intentional is really tough for some people, you know? And I want to have some grace for the folks that struggle with that. You know, I have atheist friends, and for whatever reason, they struggle with the affirmation that the universe is on purpose because of all of that, you know, all of that implies. And, you know, they say things about us that, like, it's wishful thinking and whatever. It's like, yeah, whatever. It's wishful thinking, but it's also, you know, a bazillion facts, the fine tuning of the universe, or this concept we're talking about, that the abstract is coherent with the concrete, or music or art or, you know, math, or, I mean, any of it. If you are open hearted, I just think you can see God in all of it. And I don't mean like in the animalistic sense, I'm sorry, the animistic sense or the spiritism sense, where God is in everything as they mean it. I just mean you can see his fingerprints on everything. And man, what a mathematician he must be. I mean, the language of God is any language in human experience, obviously, but math is one of those languages. And we have not plumbed the depths of mathematics. You know, I'm pretty bad at math, by the way, so that's probably why I'm a bit mystified by it, and it's kind of got this mystique and this. I'm hoping that one of my kids turns out to be really great at math, so that I can kind of have like a connection point with the deeper maths. I think when I kind of think of them as like, you know, Aslan's deeper magic, you know, that's kind of how math feels to me. It's like in the math, maybe deep down, you start to see the face of God or something. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's down there. I've never descended to those, you know, the deep magic of the complex mathematics. But to me, it just feels correct, you know, that this coherency that we see, this inexplicable existence of the perception of music, or the perception of beauty, just beauty in general, that like, I see the combination of kind of a light blue and an orange as something beautiful, you know, to see that, what is that, complementary, I think, is that color scheme. That's kind of inexplicable why that is more pleasing than some other, you know. Some would probably say, well, It's because, millions of years of evolving humanoids were looking at sunsets. It's like, yeah, or a simpler answer is just like we were designed to like it. You know, he wanted to write enjoyment into our experience. You know, so this idea is just, I don't know. It's something I don't feel like I hear talked about much in apologetics, but if I'm being honest, I don't listen to apologetics much. I'm very convinced myself. I've been involved in doing apologetic stuff, but I'm not, it's odd. I don't listen to apologetics recreationally, but I did do it as a part of our ministry for a while. Like Bible teaching, I generally don't listen to Bible teaching recreationally, but I do it kind of on like a daily and weekly basis, you know. Like somebody asked me the other day, who's your favorite Bible teacher? And I just was kind of stumped. I was like, I don't have one, I guess. I don't know. It wasn't like I didn't know what they're asking. I knew what they're asking, but my answer wound up being, I actually don't listen to Bible teaching recreationally. I listen to Bible teaching when it happens, you know, and I'm there, but honestly, a lot of times I'm the one teaching, I guess. And so I don't know. My favorite Bible teacher is Jesus, I guess. He taught the Bible, you know? So it was a good question. I wondered if maybe should I have a favorite? Maybe I should have a favorite, but I just couldn't answer it. I just kind of was stumped. I'm not stumped much, you know, as far as like, I don't know what to say, but I just didn't know what to say because I hadn't really ever thought of it in terms of favorites, you know? It's kind of getting off the point. Actually, I don't know if there's a point. This is a ramble. So, you know, I think there's probably a lot of examples of these kind of like subjective proofs of a designer, of a creator, that take an interpretive, like a mental interpretive process to kind of just consider. Like, you know, I don't know. Is it actually proof? Maybe proof isn't the right word. Maybe it's evidence or something, but it's like, it still takes a brain to think about it and say, yeah, I'm convinced that that is evidence, or I'm not convinced that that's evidence or whatever. But I do think that a person, you know how they used to say, I don't know if anybody says this anymore, but they used to say all roads lead to Rome. I kind of feel like all open-hearted travelers find their way to their creator. You know, it's like all roads can lead to God if you're open-hearted about it. And the roads here are just like any subject of study. Let's say you're a paleontologist. Can that lead you to God? Absolutely. If you're open-hearted and you follow your passion and you are, you know, and you are willing to be both convinced but also like wooed by your creator, he can do that through paleontology, you know, or whatever practice, you know, lawn care or rock and roll or whatever you want, whatever you pursue, whatever your passion is, you can pursue that and you can find the Lord. Now there are some passions that can be twisted into vices, obviously. And what I don't mean is that so let's say that your passion is to be romantic. Well, twisting that into a vice would be to be a pervert, to be perverted, you know, and to go outside of the boundaries that God set up. But if your passion is to be romantic, then get married and be romantic. Be romantic as much as you want. Free green light, free game, you know, whatever. Be romantic within those boundaries. And so what I don't mean is if you take a passion and you turn it into a vice, you actually are turning the opposite direction. So that's not an open-hearted way to pursue your passion toward your creator. But I think anybody that has a passion or an interest or a hobby or a field of study that is open-hearted and interested in finding the truth about God, I think you can find it in anything. And why is that? Because I think it all converges. I think the deeper you get into lawn care or algebra or chemistry or anything, the more you can be open to that convergence point where things all kind of point toward God. Now, if I'm being honest, I'm not exactly sure how it works with lawn care, but a lawn care person could probably tell me. I've got a buddy that I talk about occasionally who's a farmer. I went and visited him and he talked a lot about the Lord and how things that he's doing point him to the Lord on the farm, you know? And that's because he's open-hearted. He's open-minded about what God wants him to see and what he's doing. And it's really beautiful. It converges with the spiritual, you know? So yeah, I mean, anything we pursue, I think we can find the Lord in it. Not anything that we pursue. I would say anything that is godly, you know. If we turn things into vice, obviously we're gonna be going the other direction. And I think maybe, see, this is one of the challenges, is like, we have really just a culture war going on, right? I mean, like, ever since evolution became a talking point of secular education, and when I say secular education, I don't necessarily mean bad education. I just mean of the, you know, the Western civilization's education system. Ever since evolution, and maybe before that, it was other things, but evolution is the one that's fresh to me, kind of like within my lifetime. Ever since that became a strong talking point, there's kind of grown this divide between the, what you might think of as secular science and, you know, faith-based practitioners of science. And they've kind of divided into these groups that are separate, but I'm like, there's no secular science. There's no faith-based science. It's all God's science, you know. But I think what's happened is that there are certain practitioners of science, and I'm using practitioners intentionally because that feels more accurate than scientists. It's practitioners. It's, science clergy, you know, those who kind of teach science as a, you know, as a faith rather than a means to, you know, obtaining knowledge. There are those who teach that, kind of as a practitioner, you know, as they practice it sort of as a faith, and they have become kind of the enemy, right? And those in the, I'm pretty conservative, so those in kind of like the conservative circles then sort of target them as the enemy, and it's us versus them. And I'm like, dude, that's just such a mess because people in the sciences are so capable of experiencing like those aha moments. I mean, gosh, that's what science does, is you have these aha moments. And if they are not jaded by feeling like they're in the battlefield, I actually think science can lead people right to God's doorstep. I mean, he made the thing, right? I just don't feel like we have to be scared that, you know, I mean, there is just, I think there's some deception going on, and I think there's that kind of thing, but I'm just like, it's so sad to me that we've gotten to the point where science is the bad guy, you know? I mean, like, to me, science is not the bad guy. Science is great. And there are lots of Christians, there's lots of, well, people of various faiths that are in the sciences. Now, they may be kind of bowled over and feel like they can't share what they think and feel about their faith, but there are lots of people in the sciences that are strong in the faith, you know. And so, I just don't think of them as the enemy. I think there are those who have created a type of pseudo religion out of science. But that's not what I'm arguing against. That obviously is kind of a twisted thing, but that's not what I don't want to, I don't want to pretend like that's the entirety of science. You know, science includes the things we also agree on too, you know, like we basically agree on the laws of physics. Christian or not, we agree on the laws of physics. It's like that's science as well, you know. And so when we say, I don't want to be involved in science or hear about science, I'm like, I just think we're cutting ourselves off if we're not careful. I don't know what the answer is though, you guys. I mean, it just makes me sad. It makes me sad because I love that stuff so much, you know? Like I love talking about science. I'm not a good scientist, you know? I'm not a scientist, but I love talking about it. And what excites me the most is the connection points or those convergence points where they touch on the eternal, you know, where they touch on the, on our creator. That's the exciting thing to me, you know, and that's part of science too. So some try to use it as a tool to push people away from Christ. Some people try to use it as a tool to push people toward Christ. So I don't know how to help in any of that. It's not really my realm, but it is a place that I do feel like we need God's hand in directing those who are open-hearted to draw others in, you know? How cool would it be to regularly pray for a revival within the scientific community? Have you ever prayed for a revival in the scientific community? I haven't. It just never occurred to me. But why not? I mean, right now, the sciences are like the thought leaders. I mean, like, you know, science is sort of treated as inalienable. What if all the scientists got saved? What would that mean for the, you know, for the credibility of the faith, you know? It's like, I think what would happen is culturally we'd shift to some other thing, whether it creates some new magisteria or something that's not the sciences. But like for a time, the kind of influence that could bring, if there began to be revival within the sciences, that's so exciting. That's a cool idea for a story. Maybe I should write that story. Hey, here's another thought, just kind of like on the apologetics thing. And it kind of leans on maybe statistics, thinking about things in terms of statistics. If everybody in the world thought they saw the same thing, like let's say a red balloon float over their house. If everybody in the world thought they saw a red balloon float over their house, you know, would we agree that a red balloon probably floated over some houses? I mean, I'd say, yeah. I mean, like statistically, it's just too unlikely if everybody thought they saw that, you know, that means something. So if half of the world's population thought that they saw a specific event or, you know, believed a certain thing, would that mean that it has credibility? I would say absolutely. 4 billion people, you know, 4 billion people think a thing. Well, then it might be right, it might be wrong, but it's something worth investigating, right? And so I was thinking about what are the things that the vast majority of the world's population agree on? And, you know, just like by the statistics, because those generally are things that we ought to give credibility to. It doesn't mean that they're precisely right necessarily, but it means that there's things that are worth the investigation. There are things that are worth considering. And so like if you were to chart out some of the basic things that the vast majority of the world's population, think, one of the things would be life after this life, you know, life after death. Now, there's lots of disagreement on what it looks like, but the vast majority of the world thinks that there is some form of life after death. And not because they've seen it, and in some cases not even because they've been told that. Just the vast majority thinks that, you know? And so does that mean that it's fundamentally right? Well, not necessarily, but it does mean that it's worth consideration if billions of people think that there is. You could put also that there is a creator, you know, and there's differences of opinions on how he created. Did he use evolution or did he do it in 6 days or, you know, did he explode it out of a primordial ball of chaos or did he speak it? I mean, there's lots of disagreement, but most, you know, the vast majority believe that there was a creator. So you see what I'm doing here. You can begin to build some basic common ground among all populations. And it doesn't mean that you necessarily arrive at any single religion, by the way, but what it does mean is that there is a huge body of statistical, population conviction, I guess you'd say, that I just think that atheists basically just ignore or kind of brush away. Like I saw a thing the other day in this atheist guy who's well known. He said, I just think that people's ability to believe something that isn't true is really powerful. You know, lots of people believe things that aren't true. And then he gave some examples of some cults, some suicide cults where like 19 people killed themselves because they were convinced in the Halley's Comet thing. And then I don't know how many, yeah, what was it, like 800 or 900 killed themselves in Jonestown? You know, so like, yeah, but those are huge outliers. So those sound like big numbers. But when you compare them against the population of the world and say how many people are willing to kill themselves for an idea, you know, that seems kooky to the rest of everybody else, it's really small, you know, it's small numbers. And so those are outliers. And I don't think that that proves that people just will believe whatever. I mean, like in my experience, people can be particularly skeptical of things that they haven't seen. And then, but there is a case where people can be particularly believing of things that they haven't seen too. But I think in the long run, over time, I think the truth comes out. And this is a persistent belief from the earliest human recorded history that people have believed in something beyond the physical. They have believed in something, some power that's above us. And they would say they had evidence. You know, we'd say, oh, they just made that up or they were just dumb or something. But no, they, from their perspective, they had evidence. And so I think statistically you've got to account for that. If you're going to be an atheist, well, you don't have to. You can do whatever you want. But if you're going to be a coherent atheist and deal with the actual issues, I mean, it's like you're just saying, like, you know, the vast majority of people throughout all of history are just like wrong because they're dumber than me, you know, because they're just stupid or they, you know, it seems so prideful. And maybe from their perspective, what we're doing seems prideful too. It probably does. But what we're doing has a precedent And, you know, I don't know. I just, I don't know where to go with that. It just, seems incredibly prideful. It seems like it's setting the individual up as the, you know, like the final arbiter of what's true and being willing to just reject, you know, let's just, you know, we have this sense in Western civilization, I think, that we are the pinnacle. You know, we have arrived. We're smarter than any other generation that has lived. And that must mean that we can just discount thousands of years of, you know, of human experience. But I think that's a misunderstanding of the difference between having technology and actual intelligence. I don't think we're more intelligent. I think we may have more facts that we generally have memorized than people in the ancient world. And I think we have more leisure time, which leads to more educational time than people in the ancient world. But I don't think we're more intelligent. I mean, in fact, if anything, it seems like probably, I don't know this, I'm guessing that our DNA kind of degrades over generation after generation. Maybe it doesn't, but it seems like it would. It seems like if anything, wouldn't we be getting less sharp, you know, as we're creating new technologies and, you know, augmenting our abilities through computation, computers and AI, it kind of gives us the sense that we have arrived at something, some kind of singularity where we're more intelligent, but I don't think so. I think we're on par with people of all times, and we just have more resources and more opportunities to augment our basic education, you know, augment with education. That being the case, I think it makes it, if that is true, I think it makes it a lot harder to just discount people's experience for thousands of years, you know. Just because someone ran a farm 500 years ago in the middle of, you know, the middle of Europe, that doesn't mean that their experience is just to be discounted. You know, people all through history have thought that they have come from a creator, and they thought that by looking at the basic facts of their experience and their world and their own obvious complexity. It just seems so prideful to just throw all of that away and say, we know way more. Because I don't think being able to get a little deeper in math and being able to describe a little bit more accurately, the spectral analysis of a star. I think we've moved an inch in a vast array of information. I think we could continue to study the universe for, you know, a million years and still be learning, you know. So for us to think that we have arrived at something that makes it where we can discount the experiences of people for the last 6,000 years or whatever, it seems so prideful. I think if we can see ourselves as just others in a long line of equals, I think it's a healthier perspective. But hey, you know what? I doubt this is going to sway. I don't know. Maybe it will, but I doubt this is going to sway anybody that's determined to be an atheist and determined to shake their fist at God. I mean, I don't know. These are just my thoughts. It's kind of how it feels to me. So, hey, I've done 49 minutes. That's probably enough. This episode. See, I said it's enough, and now I'm going to say something else. This episode is a little different than some of the other ones because a lot of times I'm trying to speak in a way that my kids would understand. But I think every once in a while, I may just take off that guardrail and just say, you know, I'm going to ramble in Lucas language because the language inside my head is a little different than the language that I use to make sure that my kids could understand or whatever, you know. So hopefully that didn't
Hopefully that didn't turn you off or make you feel annoyed. It does.
Blabbing in that way. But maybe it connects with somebody. I hope it does. I hope somebody out there listened to this and it was meaningful. So let me just talk directly to you, listener, my fellow rambler. I really hope that what you take from this, if you haven't believed in a creator, I hope that you believe that there's a creator. And if you've kind of run aground on that, I hope that you'll consider it anew. I hope you'll think about it fresh. And there's lots of reasons. There's a lot of intellectual reasons, but I really believe that that trying to debate out the intellectual reasons is a red herring. I don't think that's necessarily where you meet your creator. I think it's worth asking, is there a conscience in me that at some point was telling me to stop, turn around, go another direction, don't engage in some type of, whether it be, you know, behavior or lifestyle or whatever. I really think that is the moment when you have a moment, or maybe many moments, where you ignored your conscience and started moving in a different direction, counter to your conscience. That's the moment to investigate. And those are rarely intellectual moments. Those are rarely moments where you just decided it with dignity and intelligence that, look, agree to disagree with the God of the universe. That's not usually how it goes. Usually how it goes, from my experience, is like, you know, I started doing, following this lifestyle that then drew me away from other believers. And I got isolated and I got bitter. And then I started wrestling with the intellectual questions. What that says to me is that the intellectual questions, those intellectual debates, they're not the real problem. The real problem is something actually deeper than that. It's that we all are capable of moving away from our Creator. We all are capable of loving things and pursuing things that are vice rather than virtue. And those twisted things that we pursue, those earthly things that we worship, they can turn us around and have us walk in the other direction. And I know atheists will mock this. I think an atheist will mock this if they hear it. They will mock this. But why do you need to mock something if it isn't true? You know, like why the vitriol? Why would you need to make fun of it if it just isn't true? I mean, why not just be like, yeah, that's just not true, and move on? But we mock the things that touch a nerve, you know, and so I think maybe the thing to end on is that verse in Hebrews. I don't have it memorized. It's the something of sin, the deceptiveness. Hebrews 3:13. Well, 12 and 14 are good too. So it says, "See to it, brothers, that none of you has a wicked heart of unbelief that turns away from the living God." I mean, that's really interesting to me because he's talking to people that apparently were not always turned away from God, but unbelief turns them away from God. And then there's a kind of this question, well, how did that happen? How did they get to the point where they had wickedness and unbelief? or they had a wicked heart of unbelief. And the next verse says, but exhort one another daily as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. And so what I hear in that is, especially for someone who was a Christian turned atheist, I think this is talking about that exact thing, you know, someone who believed in the Lord and then they turned their back on God. And it just says that the reason, I mean, it points to the reason is because of the deceptiveness of sin. It doesn't say people turn their back on God, they have unbelief because they have unanswered philosophical questions or unanswered intellectual questions. It says that the thing that you turn your back on God because of is the deceptiveness of sin. And so if it was just sin, if it was like, I'm going to sin now and I don't want God to see, so I'm going to turn your back, that would be different. But that's not how it works. Sin is deceptive. Sin makes you, leads you, guides you in how to preserve your dignity. Supposed dignity, I guess I should say. And so sin teaches you how to walk away from God and make it seem like it was his fault. I mean, that's deceptive, man. That is the deceptiveness of sin. The deceptiveness of sin leads you to the point where you have a hardened mind and heart, to where you're pulling away from God because of your sin. But your sin is so deceptive that it sends out this red herring and says, no, I'm pulling away from God because I have all of these intellectual questions that no one can answer. And do you see what that does? That's just layering another sin on top. It's called pride. Like, I'm too smart. I'm so much smarter than everybody else. Everybody else is an idiot, or everybody else is dumb, and they can't answer these big, important, deep questions that I have. And so you run away, and you make it their fault as you run away. But it's you that's running away, and it's you that's running away because of your sin, because of the deceptiveness of your sin. And the sin could be different. I'll tell you what it was for me. I never became an atheist, but I felt myself pulling away, and the deceptiveness of my sin my sin was pornography, and it was deceptive, man. And the other sins too, and a pretty extreme pride, and that led to kind of a semi-extreme legalism. All of these are sins, right? And so that those sins kind of were this concoction that led me to blame the people around me, to blame even other church people. And I was just so bitter and I was so mad. And I see now, and nobody's coercing me to say this, okay? So nobody's forcing me to say this. Nobody's standing over me with a riding crop and gonna whip me if I don't say this. I'm saying this on my own volition. What I saw, what I see now, is that it was my sin. It was my deviation from God, my deviant inner desires, that drove me to reframe my turning away from God. It's sin is deceptive. And I know you're thinking, it sounds so old school. You sound like an old school preacher saying sin is the cause. I'm like, yeah, maybe there's one guy in a million that really is primarily about an intellectual question, but I just don't think so. I think it's sin. I think it's always sin. And I think that because I really believe that someone who approaches God with an open heart and an open mind will find him, will believe in him, will seek him even more. I just think that's the nature of the universe. I think it all converges. I think it all comes to a point, a sharp, an infinitesimally sharp vertex that points to our Creator. And I think if we can come to him with an open heart and an open mind, I think that's what happens. But one of the main problems is that sin is in all of us, and sin is deceptive, and so that sin blocks our minds and our hearts from seeing him clearly and experiencing him the way that is pure, and so it just gets all warped and messy. But exhort one another daily, as long as it is called the day, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. I don't know. Again, I have very little hope that, like, a staunch atheist is going to hear that and say, oh, you're right. It is because of my sin. it's hard to believe, but they've mocked us so much. We've been mocked so much for kind of like supposedly cramming religion down their throat that we've started to stop saying that. And we've started to play along and pretend as if what we're really dealing with is intellectual questions, but I just don't think they are. For me, the intellectual questions are a great faith builder once you're in the family. You know. Now, I've engaged in apologetics and done the intellectual question stuff because it's good for traffic. But what I realized as we were doing it is that what I was helping was not actually atheists. We had a branch of our ministry called Questions from Atheists, and I thought I'm going to help atheists like come out of their atheism and, you know, it'd be a great thing. But really what happened was it was really more of a faith builder for Christians who had been kind of bombarded by atheists. And I realized, you know, I think apologetics is actually more about discipleship than it is about converting people. Now, there are definitely people that convert after looking at apologetics stuff. My theory that I'm giving you, I guess I can't really account for that. I don't know. But I think the vast majority of people that consume apologetics are actually Christians. And I think it's actually for the good of their discipleship. And as long as we understand that, that's fine. You know, it's great. It's great stuff. It's really valuable. And I can get way more excited about building people's faith through apologetics within the ranks of the household of the faith than I can about trying to convert people that have abandoned the faith. Although I am excited about that too sometimes, but a lot of the times it just feels so fruitless. But that's probably because I haven't been called to it. You know, there's probably people out there that are just fantastic at it. But I see these guys that do these apologetics things where they have people come up to the mic and they have them argue them. I'm just like, is that winning the heart of that person? And maybe sometimes it is, you know, but it seems like it's just embarrassing them. It is, they feel belittled or something. I don't know. And maybe it's working. I've just never really gotten into that style. But anyway, I said I was going to stop, like, let's see, how long ago? 1 hour and 3 minutes. Oh yeah, a few minutes ago I said I'd stop, about 10 minutes ago. How about I stop now? Hey, thanks for listening, you guys. That was quite a ramble, but hopefully it did something for you. We'll see you. Later.